Hello, 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 and welcome to Conversations. I'm Eliana.
And I'm Patrick. Hi.
Now, we're going to be doing episode 2 of our coverage of the 77th edition of the Cannes Film Festival.
And we are on day 4?
Yes, we're on day 4 already. My, the time flies, the films are almost a blur. But today, we're going to talk about, we're going to finish the cliffhanger that we last left you on, Ma Vie, Ma Gueule, or This Life of Mine by Sophie Filière.
Quite a different title in the translation, right?
It is. And we'll talk about Bird by Andrea Arnold. I just saw that earlier today with you. And we'll also try to get to It Doesn't Matter by Josh Mund.
Right. And which is a film that is more like of an outlier, which is playing at acid.
Yes, here. In the acid section, which is a parallel section that is about independent cinema and its distribution. And perhaps, Patrick, I don't know, maybe you'll give us
We'll see.
Because you also saw Furiosa, which is also the talk of the town, along with Megalopolis, which you will cover.
I feel like Megalopolis has that all wiped down. You know, no one talks about Furiosa anymore. Now it's all about this grandiosely received film Megalopolis. But yeah, let's see. And perhaps, Eliana, because you just come from a screening of Megalopolis, we don't talk about the film, but because to me it was such a distinct experience, like I can only, you know, the one experience I can relate it to is seeing the new Polanski last year in Venice, which completely broke me, like in a negative way, you know. I felt like, oh, what am I doing here? What kind of profession am I pursuing here? Is this what I want to spend my time with? And this is a bit how I felt with Megalopolis, without saying too much about it. Was that also such a brain fuck to you?
I think I might have more tolerance than you for this film, because I did not go in. I don't know if you had expectations, but I just went in to it, and I admire his vision, and that comes through. And there were little things that I found that I entertained myself with throughout the film, like the costume design and some placement of art, or even the idea of the architectural future scapes that were to be invented that maybe took heavily from mycelium designs, etc. But ultimately,
so I sense you're not broken.
I'm not as broken as you are. That is for sure. Well, but maybe we'll talk about this film on another episode.
Sure, but good to hear, because we're looking here at the Crozet Bay, at the Cannes Bay, and the sun is out today, and it's really a beautiful sight. And it would be be a pity to be devastated by the second film only you saw today.
That's true.
Yeah, let's maybe dive into the into our first film today, which is the Sophie Filière film Ma Vie, Ma Gueule. We already mentioned it last time. That's a filmmaker who's passed away last year, and the project was passed on to her two children and also some producers who were involved in the project to edit it together and just finish the project, basically. And in a way, I don't know, would you say that is a film as personal as it gets for a swan song, for a final chapter of a career?
I would say so. I mean, I think it's in the production of the film, and especially the post-production, which is very sad. The film itself is very, very, it's a very beautiful film. And it definitely moved me, made me laugh. And I think it is something I think that was done with such a heart and such a spirit by the people who took over afterwards. I mean, the family members, Agathe and Adam Bonitsa. That it really, it's also very sad in another sense, because it's about a woman who's aging, and she dons the name Barbie Bichette, Barbie Bichette all of her life, which is such a
right. Her real name is Barbie, but everyone calls her Barbie, and that's this thing. And she's played by Agnès Jaoui, and apparently there was this strong connection between the director and the actor, and it has been reported a lot that she plays sort of a stand-in for the director.
Yes. There was a bit of a Q&A afterwards, and the actor, Agnès Jaoui, said that she literally wore the clothes and the rings and the shoes that were Sophie Filière's.
Yeah, so...
It can't really be separated. Right? I mean, the auto fiction or however it is to be taken, because I don't even... There's something about this that is both auto-fictional, but that also rejects in a different way, but I don't know. Maybe that's for you.
Yeah, but I mean, it starts from the very first scene, right? We see her at at her laptop, mm-hmm. and she's searching first for the title of the mm-hmm. film, and apparently this has always been how Filière found her subjects. She was looking for these titles first, and those would give her some ideas how to go on with a story and build that around that.
Mm-hmm.
And she's then after that looking for a font, you know, and I thought at first, oh, this is one of these silly procrastination scenes, you know, but it wasn't that at all. And we are soon led into her life of idiosyncrasy, basically, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. She has a very idiosyncratic life. And at the core of it is that she had a life as a poet. And what does this mean to be in the contemporary world as a poet, a published poet as well? From the beginning, language is already effusive in the film. I mean, with what you just said, that she's trying to choose a font. And there's a lot of comedy in this too. I mean, the first motion that we have of her is that she's putting on her glasses, and we can tell that one of the arms of her glasses is broken. And then while she goes through the fonts, there's one particular font. I mean, I'm giving too much away, but I won't. But I like it, I think
it
says
the first 5 minutes or so, and I think it gives us a good sense,
yes,
right?
It sets up a very good understanding. But there's a font called Avenir, which means future, and so she plays with the different boldnesses of this future, and there's one that's just called Avenir Oblique. And
which, you know, in retrospect made me also think, because we are introduced to her as a poet, but we are also introduced to her as working at an like marketing company, basically. So as if, you know, this font mm-hmm. is as important as the text itself, or has become that. And yeah, so there's this I found fun scene later when she goes to the company, writes a quick poem mm-hmm. on a flip chart,
yeah,
right, and then leaves the office again. And so there is this financial necessity mm-hmm. to work for that ad company, but at the same time, that's not her, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also perhaps in the greater sense, this captures how she's in between different worlds and how she often cannot really perhaps tell them apart, or you know, live with the contradictions that are inherent in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What else is there? I will. Yeah, I found there's so many beautiful things thematically about this film, because I suppose we're trying not to give away too many spoilers nor to do too deep an analysis. But in terms of the maturity of this woman, there's something that is both very naive and childlike, not really like not naive perhaps, but childlike and cynical, but childlike in her embrace. And many instances occur to her. So we watch her as she as things happen to her. There's a passivity in which she goes through certain scenes and that they're cut as little episodes almost. She's a mother of two also in the film. And there's this dynamic between the parent, the mother, and the children that's also very endearing, that tests this idea of how well they know her and how who is perhaps parenting right. whom. And
yeah, I think that was well captured. There's this scene at a boat or on a ship later that I won't go into, but there was a very heartfelt scene, I think. And to just to demonstrate how closely they got to her real personal environment. Also, the psychiatrist, for instance, was her real psychiatrist.
Yes, yes.
And
oh, wow.
Of course, here he's played as a very silly guy, you know, who is just asking things like, très bien, or saying things like, très bien. Yeah, as it's actually not saying anything. And just to show you how anarchic is it?
Anarchic.
Yeah. Just to show you how anarchic the film is, it's divided into three parts, and these parts are titled Piff, Puff, and Yuku. So so it's almost onomatopoetic, right? There was this. I feel like this is a character who's divergent in many ways, and one can assume that there's something not just right with her, just or divergent that is not normal. But the film presents this as if there is a possibility to reclaim normalcy and to broaden, you know, our understanding of what normalcy entails. And there were many scenes that were just deadpan, many scenes where we are being shown something, but she's actually doing the opposite thing. You know, like when she calls her friend and tells her the exact opposite of what she's doing in that moment. As you said, very episodic, right? There is this scene with the two allegedly deaf girls.
This was such a good scene, but a good scene. Yes.
Yeah.
We shall not say anything to ruin it.
But dear listener, you may have in the past yourself have encountered people who come to you at a park or at a restaurant or something, and they hold a sign to you where it says, "We are deaf and we need financial support and help and so on. Could you please sign this list and support us with money and so on?" And this film does something with that, which I found was quite, you know, it puts you at a spot that is not so difficult to that is not so easy to handle, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, ultimately, the character that's created of Barbary, is a person who's very sensitive to her outside surroundings, notices when something has changed suddenly, and is someone who also, like you said, I mean, in this atypical somewhat way of navigating. She goes to therapy, but at the same time, perhaps we find later on that she, in some sense, emancipates her from that type of an experience. And really, I don't know, maybe this is a different interpretation, but that what she looks for some form of connection by looking to the past.
Yeah, and also she often finds connections when she's not directly involved with people. She's always striving for solitude, but it feels like she's never lonely, you know?
Yes.
And I think the movie handles it incredibly well to give us a sense of the people surrounding her understanding or coming to terms with who she is as a person and realizing how to deal with her and how to treat her in a way that is respectfully and understands her idiosyncrasies.
Yes. I mean, it is a theme. What is the nature of a person? And she asks herself, what is my nature? Because she recognizes that another person that she's encountered says, oh, that is not my nature. And so thus somewhat also begins her own search for what her so-called nature is. Which I agree with you. You know, it's very hard to put a finger on this. One last thing that I'd like to mention is that the poems that are written are actually the poems of Sophie Filière as well, which is a lovely touch. And there's just such a simplicity in the rhyme and the beauty of the embrace of the language and how when one observes or experiences or sees that instinct to then write down. So at some point too, she also has her published book on her and she starts writing again and she starts writing in her very own book, which is then discovered by her children, which is also a lovely just continuation of whatever this, something that describes one's work that can be, I guess, encompassed in just one object, but also taken and portable. I don't know. I just quite like the film.
No. Yeah, I agree. And in France, she had this reputation as well of writing these very clever, very cheeky and funny and flippant dialogues, and I think that's here as well. And I also, as you know, I always like it when films center on language and how this can be conveyed. And here we also later she goes on this journey and ends up in England, and there she also finds some nice entrances to depict language barriers and how this can be depicted. So yeah, I think overall we really liked it. No,
yes.
It's a good one. So that was Ma Vie, Ma Gueule by Sophie Filière, and they played in the Quinzaine de la des Cinéastes, exactly. So director's fortnight.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess the meaty part of our conversation today is reserved for Andrea Arnold's Bird.
Oh, goodness. Right? Yes.
Which we just saw a few hours ago in the best possible presentation here in Cannes, which is the IMAX screen. One always has to get a bit, it takes a while to get there on the bus because it's not here at the Croisette where the festival mainly takes place. But it's a bit, outside-ish. At a place that looks more like, I don't know, like California or something.
Yes.
Fields and the hills in the background. In any case, Andrea Arnold, could you tell us a bit about her? Because you also had the chance to go to her retro screening of Red Road. And she was also given a prize here this year at Cannes.
Yeah, I saw Red Road for the first time, and there was a surprise masterclass or appearance. Masterclass might be a bit of an exaggeration, but she was present, and she was such a lovely, warm presence, and she was sitting with her feet in like a chalice position, as is tentatively feeling somewhat comfortable and sort of... This was a new-ish experience in some sense. And her films, they're really difficult often. I find many of them, they deal with different, just so many different themes of the female, the body, the gaze, voyeurism, surveillance, intimacy, and the ways that womanhood often, because primarily many of her films have been centered from the POV of a female, different, the way that womanhood and the body and the relation, interrelations with those around are broken or corrupt or just disrupted by either society or just circumstance, really, because often they're portraits that take on a type of a desire for the audience to root for the character, and there's something in it. I don't know. It's very difficult to actually talk about her cinema. I don't know, because it's and she often transgresses. So I believe in Milk, there's a unity between an older, an adult man and a woman, a mother, who's mourning the loss of her child. And that unity comes from a breastfeeding scene. And I think it's really worth watching, because there's something so very powerful about seeing something like that. It was very curious to attend the masterclass, because she talked a lot about how she starts to develop her films. So she starts with an image, and she even expressed this almost, not disappointment, but frustration with, oh, why couldn't I have been a painter or a poet? Why do I decide to make films? It takes 3 years to make a film, or perhaps more. And it's such a long and difficult process. Why couldn't I just see the image and then paint it? But for her, she sees the image and then she decides how to build a script or a scene as if like a puzzle piece to create the whole entire thing around that one image. So for example, in some of the films that she's well known for, American Honey
and
Fish Tank, I believe it's in Fish Tank that she starts with, she started with an image of a young woman peeing on the carpet in another person's house. And from there, built out everything. And she's a filmmaker that rejects, I think, a lot of the strict film technique language. So she said that she doesn't like it when her scripts include things like cut, or even if they're numbered. And I think we saw that today, or maybe you caught that today, in the credits, which was so curious, but they were just completely alphabetized mm-hmm. by first name. And it was just a massive list of names of people who must have worked on Bird. She often films with one camera, and the cameraman, a handheld camera. Usually she's done 4-3 ratio, and she's worked very frequently with Robbie Ryan, who has also been the cinematographer for Yorgos Lanthimos's most recent films, Poor Things, I think Kinds of Kindness as well, and The Favorite, among some other films.
Naya.
We should get into the film a bit.
So perhaps let's transition to, we can say American Honey was sort of an outlier in the sense that she went to the United States, right? Which is not her home turf.
Yes.
And there was also already 8 years ago in 2016, she won the jury prize for that film, then came back 3 years ago with Cow, which was this sort of documentary about the dairy industry. And now she's back with her fiction project. And perhaps, what was the prompt? Because you just said she starts with an...
Because she did not reveal that masterclass.
But she did at the press conference.
She did? Yes. Okay.
And the prompt here, like the visual prompt, this image she had, was a thin man, a thin man with a long penis standing on a roof or something. And as we know now, I think we don't reveal too much. Apparently that has manifested as Franz Rogowski. So
there were moments in Bird where I thought, is he naked or not? I don't know if we can talk about that later, but when he's standing on the roof.
I mean, I'm all in for talking about a naked Franz Rogowski, but I don't. Yeah, I don't recall if like he always has this outfit, right?
He has an outfit on that's a bit off skin. I wasn't sure.
Yeah. But so Bird.
Bird.
Very interesting film, I think. It stars a newcomer. Her name is Nikia Adams. She has the leading role here. She's a 12-year-old girl, and she lives, as so often, in rather impoverished family and milieu overall, I would say. And as much as Andrea Arnold's films are character studies, they're also always a milieu studies. And here she goes to Kent to the
which is southeast of London.
Exactly.
It's its own area.
Yeah, and next to her feature Barry Keoghan as her father, and we have this friend that apparently she needs in her life because she needs someone to follow at this moment in her life, and this person is Franz Rogowski's character, Bird.
Mm-hmm.
His name is just Bird. And yeah, I think it's a very interesting dynamic. I must say I'm not I know there's a huge fan base centering on Barry Keoghan. So far, I didn't count myself in. But this was a really good performance, mm-hmm. I think. Him as a father, I'm not sure we can go into that. I'm not sure if I completely bought, you know, the movie is very centered on her perspective, mm-hmm. and she is very antagonistic to her father, which I guess you can, given the circumstances, her financial, like her upbringing and their financial outlook, it's really rough. But at the same time, I never had this feeling that, you know, he doesn't love her or something. There was always warmth. Mm-hmm. So I found it almost a bit forced that she was depicted as so antagonistic towards him.
Oof, I can understand what you're saying. I think it's just very hard because when we just think about the family structure and how, and this film for me in a sense is also kind of like a type of, I wouldn't call it a genre, but it almost is, that we both like, of just sort of found families. And so Barry Keoghan's character, Bug, he's had previous children, and they come from, there are a few fathers, there are a few mothers, and everyone is somewhat related and not related, and there's a bit of, there's both community and there's also a sense of responsibility, and there's also a sense of antagonism between all the family dynamics, especially when Bug announces that he wants his newest girlfriend, who he's met only 2 minutes ago, according to Bailey, the primary.
For 3 months.
Yeah, 3 months. And I think that this disruption and this sense of not really, there's something also very lively about Keoghan's character that is very, very irresponsible. And it's very clear that that even though he's full of so much love,
he's full of love, but he's also full of love for drugs, right?
Yes.
And he buys that toad, and the toad is an investment because he needs money to pay the DJ for the wedding.
Yeah.
So what does he do? He buys a toad, and with this toad, he tries to extract some
hallucinogenic
substance.
Slime.
Yeah,
I didn't
the
know
slime,
about
exactly.
This.
I did not know about that at all. I mean, I don't even know if that is really a thing,
yeah.
But this seems also to be one of these things you find and then you cannot not feature it in your film. You know, it's too good. It's too good to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so that's his basic idea here, to extract the slime and mm-hmm. sell it so he can pay the DJ for.
Yes.
And this gives you a good idea of what kind of person he is, I think.
Yes.
But I think the way he plays it, I think it's really strong.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very strong performance.
And he has, of course, this dialect, right? he has these certain, you know, some words I didn't even recognize.
Yeah.
Like chuffed, like
chuffed. Oh, chuffed.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, chuffed.
I mean, you got it from the context that just, you know, there were certain words, certain markers that tell you, oh, this is, you know, this is not London standard English. I think also Franz Krakowski is really good in this film. I think in a sense, maybe he has an easier role to play, right? Because he's the good guy and he doesn't have to give us the full spectrum of his capacities. Mm-hmm. We do get every now and then his physicality, which is such a strong element of his acting.
It's because he has a background as a dancer,
right?
And a performer, really.
Right, he does
of all
exactly,
kinds.
Yeah, I also think the lead actress does a fantastic debut here. Her name. I mentioned that her name is Nikia Adams, and she's also a sort of filmmaker. She's a videographer. She always has her iPhone with her, and whenever something happens, as if to document that these things are really happening, mm-hmm. she records them, mm-hmm. even in scenes where I would not recommend to film, because you then wonder if people get aggressive towards you, but she does it either way, anyway, and she then projects these images onto the wall of her room, and so this is also captured in an interesting way, I think, because you don't see it as an iPhone screen, really, you know, like it's just a little projection.
Yes, you see it as a little projection, and the first time it manifests, it's in a funny geometrical shape, and it looks almost like. I was curious to know how that image was made, because I believe that this film was shot on 35mm. Just a little extra, but she tried like 15 or 16 cameras and then she went, no, actually. Sorry, producers, I want the 35mm.
And it does look beautiful.
It does.
I think this will end up being one of the most beautifully shot films of the festival. There is something weird going on, and maybe you have more knowledge about that because you know more about analog filmmaking, but you know, at the edges of the frame, it often seems like there is, as if there is an error,
like
you know,
a light leak or something. I really don't know what's going on with that, because it looks like perhaps it was scanned,
but it doesn't seem to be intentional, right? Like, because then it would be more pronounced.
I really don't know, because there were some obvious issues with the film that appeared from time to time, even on the, I mean,
yeah, and also
there was
these, scratches
lens and stuff like that, which I suppose one could edit out if they really were interested in doing that.
But sometimes you can, right?
But they were left in, but I mean, in post, digitally,
okay,
I think you can do something, but they were left in, and there's something sort of endearing and about
there's
that
some
messiness.
Rawness about that, right?
I think she did say, now that you mention it, that she did want that messiness in the frame, because you can even see the curved angle of the
hello, little disclaimer, we had technical issues today, so a good chunk of our recording earlier we could not use, so this is why we have to record it again.
So in Bird we follow Bailey, who's a 12-year-old girl. She's a bit of a tomboy. She runs around with the other people in the, well, with her
friends.
She has
a clique.
With her friends. She has a bit of a clique, but she also doesn't, because she's not a part of it, since she is a girl and everyone else is a guy. And the way that the film introduces us to the dynamics and the relationships and the structures of the relationships of the people that we interact with is very subtle, but we come to understand that in some sense, perhaps they are, they have a deeper relation on paper than they might seem to in reality. Bailey's father, played by Barry Keoghan, is someone who decides that he wants to get married to, Bailey's father decides that he wants to get married much to
Bailey's father decides that he wants to get married to his newest girlfriend, much to the dismay of Bailey. And we follow her as she eventually encounters Franz Rogoffsky's character in an open field. And it's through this tender relationship that kind of stems from an origin in almost something like looking up to a superhero to a degree or an idol that we start to that we enter the film.
Yeah, sort of. First, I thought of a satire, you know, because the way he jumps around and bumps around, and he has this sort of androgynous figure, I suppose. He this androgynous comportment. He also wears an outfit that is sort of in between.
Yes.
In between the genders. And
yes, he wears a skirt and a beige or off beige or brownish sort of almost skin color like outfit. And but maybe I'm confusing this.
I think
this
they're
too.
Different colors at different moments in the film. I don't quite recall what the first encounter. But yeah, and this is also this entire arrangement of the movie. It's a departure from her last fiction film. There was American Honey in 2016, because, well, it was about the time of Trump. And so, of course, there is. And then exploring just the street, the road, so to speak, and homelessness and precariousness and those kind of lifestyles that, are perhaps more akin to stories we all know, like On the Road. And yeah, this here, she goes back to Kent and in the southeast of England. And Barry Keoghan, for instance, he has a very strong accent in this film as well. And I think they are playing with that as well. We might, as with the other film we talked about earlier, language is here in a way also kind of just a signifier of who you are and whom you belong to. I think the film also got it right when it comes to texting in this film here. There are some, just the way language is used, that certain words are written in a way that, you know, I would not even think of that they exist, but I immediately recognize what they mean. But yeah, it's not really my register. And I think it's quite astonishing, I think, because Andrea Arnold is, I think, in her late 50s or so.
She's in her early 60s.
Early 60s, yeah.
Yeah, she started filmmaking in her 30s.
Ah, yeah. And I always find it incredible how on point her soundtrack is, for instance. American Honey was very contemporary. Some might argue too contemporary, in the sense that maybe it's less of a universal and more of a, you know, like a time capsule or something. But I think there is value in that as well. And here again, we have certain pieces that I'm not even familiar with, you know, but it felt very contemporary and it felt cool, you know. Like I think a lot of filmmakers, in once they, you know, reach a certain age, they really try to be cool, and it's very ridiculous and a bit embarrassing. But with her, I don't feel like that at all. With her, I feel like, oh, she still sort of understands youth culture, and as if she can still remember vividly how that feels like. Maybe she has some, yeah, maybe, I don't know where it comes from. Yeah, I can just speculate, but it works in her films, I think.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I mean, especially this film, as many of her films, I mean, her films have explored from characters, women from all different ages and all different types of situations. There's definitely also been a heavy theme of mothers or neglectful mothers and what happens to the children.
As is the case in this film here as well.
As is the case in this film. And how the children react, or how they take control or try to, when the mothers are So Aros is just very complex, but in a way, in how they act towards their duty of motherhood and the responsibility of actually having a child or multiple children, often as in her films.
Yeah, and at the same time, I think it's important to highlight, I mean, not that this were in any way a, you know, promoting the idea of a neglectful mother, but we are so used to seeing like neglectful fathers, right? Mm. That it is sort of almost refreshing in a way to see that with mothers as well, because there is this huge, like, mothers are hugely charged with almost like there is this legendary status of a mother who cannot do any harm to children. And if they do, that's like one of the biggest taboos we mm-hmm. have in our Western society. So I think in a way, even though, of course, we don't wish that for any child in the world, but it is useful to depict that in films as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because those things are realities. And I mean, we have mentioned Rogowski and we have mentioned Kyogen. We should give a shout out to the newcomer here who plays Bailey. That is Nikia Adams. And it's quite a remarkable performance, I would say. And you mentioned the tomboy aspect, and this is also like embedded in the film as mm-hmm. well, because at some point she cuts her hair.
Yes, at some point her hair gets cut. And I think, I mean, honestly, she has an androgynous appearance in the beginning, and I didn't even know until someone refers to her, her father refers to her, or her father's girlfriend refers to her as a she. I don't know if that happened for you. Not that it's imminently important, but there is an aspect of she is asked to wear something that would make her appear more feminine. And there's also a very beautiful shot too when she goes in water at some point, and for the first time we see the evidence of her chest development in that it's hidden behind a bra, right. But the water reveals this.
Just about this outfit thing, mm-hmm. did you really think it was like a female outfit? Because to me it was just ridiculous. This like one piece lilac leopard outfit or mm-hmm. something. I don't even know what to call it. But
what did they call it? Did they say it was a bird outfit? Or I don't know. I don't remember.
In any case, it was rather ridiculous. And so for me, femininity wasn't really foregrounded through that outfit. I don't know.
I don't know. The way that I see it is that the outfit was clearly going to be very tight. And that feeling of something that's so tight pressing against your skin and the inevitability of the form.
No, that's very
coming
good.
Coming through.
Yeah, that's very
and
good.
And feeling
also,
like you want to wear baggy clothes if you probably are not, if you're ashamed of your body type. To a degree, I don't think that this protagonist necessarily felt that way, but she always wants to hang out with the guys.
Yeah, but also, right, this is, her father wants her to wear this.
And her, yes.
Whereas the prospective bride, she is already, you know, she knows that Bailey is not going to wear this, but it's, you know, and then it being so tight that, of course, is in accordance with how she feels about her father, because one can clearly tell that, you know, this father is by no means a responsible father. He's a drug addict or like, if not addict, then at least he has he takes drugs on a regular basis, and the entire house is very messy, as one knows from earlier Arnold films, and it's all very dirty. But there is always, you can always sense that there's love for her as well from him, even though he cannot, I don't know, express it in a way that would be, I don't know, that would be well received by her. takes quite a while for the movie to explore that love further. And yeah, there's more of a rebellion against him.
Yeah, I think it really manifests in the fact that his great irresponsibility or perceived irresponsibility on behalf of Bailey's point of view or view of him, how that manifests overrides the love that he has, because he's certainly a warm and loving dad. He just is somewhat reckless and irresponsible and impulsive. He buys a toad in order to try to fund the marriage that he has, because the toad is believed to slime a product that would be a hallucinogenic that could be sold. And this is incredible. I've never heard of it before. But these sorts of tricks that the father would play to try to earn money, and I feel like Bailey knows. She's very cognizant of what he's up to and what other people do, and in understanding who's the adult in this situation. Once again, so we have a different dynamic of parenting, which is curious, since we talked a little bit about that in Ma Vie, Ma Gueule.
Yeah, and this purchase of this toad, that is almost as if to say, this is how far we go, you know, instead of finding work or something, you know, we buy this toad as an investment to get the substance to pay the DJ that the bride wants for the wedding. It's very funny. He is really not, I don't think we are introduced to him as having a job, right? He is just this regular dude, and we don't know how they even finance the apartment they have, even though it's very shabby in the first place. Yeah, and this already maybe gives us a cue into the milieu as a whole, because that's so important to Arnold's films always. They're not only character studies, they are always studies of the milieu itself. And here, what we called clique earlier, that Bailey wants to be part of, but is not quite, even though I think she's respected by everyone, but not to the extent that they would take her in on their, on their, I don't want to call them adventures because that would be euphemistic. They're sort of, they build or form sort of a vigilante group and avenge wrongdoings in the community. So when violence occurs, when people inflict violence on other people in the community, then they track them down and do horrible things to these people.
Yeah, I understood that they wanted to trace an X on their forehead, but perhaps I
and there's there's a WhatsApp group or something where they can say, oh, here's something horrible has happened, and they respond, send me the address.
And there's something about this thematically that also makes complete sense, because there are no heroes in their lives. In this, I think Click is generous. I would say kind of like, well, maybe Click is more accurate, because they're not really a gang, but they're also trying to be, they're trying to be the heroes of their lives and try to keep out and to watch out for those around. And that
police, right? It seems like this city, this village is also just neglected by police, because we never see police there as well. And we know of these places, right? When you call an ambulance and no one comes.
Yeah.
So, and then a lot of people die. Like, there was this Berlinale film 2 years or no, like, 3 years or 4 years ago by Ruiz Palacio, I think, that was in Mexico City, and people call the ambulance and it's just not coming, and this is why people die. And one one could easily imagine that the police maybe here at times might not even dare mm-hmm. go to these places.
Mm-hmm. And that brings us also to an activity that Bailey does. So she actually acts and uses her own phone camera very often in order to sort of protect herself. She takes footage of sort of incidents as they unravel whenever she might feel either that she wants to document a couple, but primarily document them for her own safety. She winds up filming initially Bird in the first encounter, where he appears out of nowhere and she's quite taken aback. And she also films two other encounters with men that
exactly, yeah.
that are confronted in the film.
Yeah, and she's the sort of videographer, and she has this little projector at home that she then, we see the phone screen basically projected onto her wall. And I think in our recording earlier that we didn't get to save, to secure, but you made quite a beautiful point about how this film recontextualizes these videos as well. Mm. Because as you just said, at first they're sort of, they give her a form of security that, if there's a threat, then she has this video that she could share with other people, so they yeah. could come at her help. But for instance, with the example of Bird, mm-hmm. As it is at first something for defense, it later turns into a very endearing memory for her. Mm-hmm. And this is something that she has now captured for herself. And
yeah.
she can think back to this time when she meet this person she urgently needed in her life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a very endearing quality to recognizing the camera not only as a tool of surveillance, but as protection. And then this translation, as you said, into, you know, even just memories, nostalgia. Right. And very different from how our times have and rightfully so, in some cases, generated how we view surveillance and privacy invasions. And how we reject the idea of even wanting to be filmed or documented. And in that sense, in that sense, the camera works as if to sometimes criminalize us, when this is exactly what she is trying to protect herself from, the fear of intimidation or violence. And Andrea Arnold, she works with surveillance, and when you see Red Road 2, there's also a heavy theme of that, and the idea of surveillance and intimacy from the POV of a security woman is very curious, because she's also a voyeur, but because she's a woman, that somehow changes something, which would be another conversation to talk about, but.
Yeah, yeah.
Very curious.
And I think what one's read that London is the most surveyed place in the world.
No, it's incredible. I mean, in this film, to the security woman or the surveiller, the city watcher, she has, I don't know, six screens on the left side, six screens on the right side, and maybe 12 screens in the middle. And she's able to literally pan through roads and mm-hmm. find intersections and change and see everything and follow whatever might be going on. And yes, it is yeah, London is heavily surveyed.
Right. And before we wrap up with this film, I think I want to once more highlight this relationship between Bailey and Franz Rogowski, because mm-hmm. it's sort of at some point it starts to form the almost like moral centerpiece perhaps of the story, and thematic centerpiece, and the way it's very cute, I think, at times, perhaps even too cute. But this first encounter is, for instance, it's just something I think that will stick with me. Mm-hmm. I will think about that a lot. And yeah, he has this very benevolent, very, very generous.
We earlier said like a fairy-like presence as he prances in the meadow, and he is able to instantly, with his energy, take Bailey away from all of the domestic crap that she's experiencing and stress and overthinking. And this is also very curious. Sorry, I'm doing the thing that I often do, I digress, but we have the dispersion of her internal thoughts, which I haven't seen yet in an Andrea Arnold film. But back to Bird. And there's something very, very lovely about his presence that's...
Yeah, and especially the dynamic between the two, right? Because at first she's so suspicious of him. She thinks he might be, a perpetrator, he might be someone who does not wish anything good for her. And she is even like benign things like, it's a beautiful day, she responds to with, what do you mean?
He says it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. She goes, what?
Yeah.
What is the day?
Yeah. And it takes quite a while for them to get on the same wavelength.
Yeah. And it reminded me, I don't know if you know this Leonard Cohen song, Bird on a Wire.
Ah.
The lyrics are like a bird on the wire. I'm not really going to sing, but like a drunk in a midnight choir, I've tried in my way to be free, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's about really the pain of trying when you're not able to, when you're not able to fit in, when you, there's some inevitability of something. And I think it's also playing with Birdman in some sense, because we have this super superhero presence and idea
Of course, the birdcage is a long-standing symbolism for the feminist idea that you have to break out of that cage. Mm-hmm. And one of the first shots of the films is her filming with the iPhone through this sort of gutter structure, or this through this fence, I think. And there behind the fence we see the birds.
We see seagulls.
Yeah, the seagulls flying through the...
Which reminds me that I did also feel that this was very much had a similar soul to La Chimera of last year, not only for the seagulls, but for these types of films that bring together families, found families,
and
found togetherness from brokenness or from people who search for that which they can no longer have, and finding a new way of achieving that. And in this film, we have a few magical realism elements that appear.
Yeah, and also very realistic depictions of families of our times, right? That sometimes it's not quite traceable who belongs to whom, where is this mother, where is this father, but those people live together and form a new sort of family. Works better or worse, but things need to keep going.
We should probably wrap up talking about this film, but I mean, we're going to try perhaps down the road to do an episode of Andrea Arnold, because she's... Did we mention the award that she's gotten this year at Cannes?
Or... not so sure. She got the Carrosse d'Or, which is the prize of the Quinzaine de Cinéastes, so the side section of the festival. And yeah, you were there present, right, when she received that? And
I don't think... I wasn't present when she received that. She received that on the opening day, I believe. And then there was this... rencontre, like this meeting with her.
I see, yeah.
But it's very sweet, because they say that this award is awarded to a filmmaker who has left their mark on the history of cinema through their audacity, demands, and intransigence in their direction. Which is, I think, quite accurate.
Yeah, and needless to say, but perhaps not, this will be one of the most beautiful films of the festival, just yes. in terms of, you know, its looks.
Yes, it's on 35mm. It's not really coming across with enthusiasm as much as it did earlier, but this film was a very special experience that was quite touching and moving in a way that I didn't expect it to be.
Yeah.
And
perhaps a bit too cute at the end. Yes. I found a bit manipulated, but you know, I still fell for it. But I wondered if I wasn't a bit tricked into feeling the way I felt. But nonetheless, that was one of the most heartfelt films I've seen so far here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we wanted to talk about another film as well, but perhaps we won't get into that today. We can leave that as another cliffhanger for the next episode, yes. even though this can by no means be our centerpiece for the next episode. But maybe we can still mention it. That is Josh Mohn's It Doesn't Matter. So the second film of the director after James White in 2015, which was a widely well-regarded film that won a lot of prizes for a debut film back at the time. And one can certainly say it's one of the more daring films of this year's programming at Cannes. And yeah, I think we'll leave it at that. I think for the next episode, what do you think? Are we talking about Megalopolis?
We should tackle this.
I don't know if I will ever be prepared for that.
I also don't know.
If I even now think about how to start, I'm at a loss.
But I think it's also, we need to find someone who perhaps quite liked the film, because I'm in between and you're really on the other end, I think.
Well, let's see if we can find someone.
Look at that positivity.
Yeah,
well, all right. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Coming to you next time with great spirits.
Bye-bye.